rebutting that evidence. I don't think there's ever been any dispute that that is proper.
Well, what if the trial court said, no, we're not going to do that? What would you, if you were there, what would you point to that says, yeah, we have a right to rebut this? We have a right to stop the trial and go and investigate something.
Sure. I don't think this has been developed in the case law, quite frankly. I can't point to a case that says that. I think by inference from the task force that's been set forth for self-defense and McMorris evidence, I think perhaps that's why we're here in part, is because there isn't that kind of a discussion in the case law.
Counsel, you changed your argument a bit as this case has unfolded, not here at oral argument, but I'm thinking of your petition for review, because then you had superintending authority, at least as I viewed it, more at the forefront of an argument than inherent authority. And I say to myself, well, that is probably just because of what you said at oral argument now. Superintending authority implicates in your argument rulemaking, and maybe it's better for rulemaking legislatively or through the court rulemaking process. But it seems to me that what you're really asking for here is a rule. And that is like alibi, that the defendant must always notify the prosecution that they're going to be relying on the defense of perfect self-defense. Isn't that what you're asking for?
Not entirely, but that's kind of why my argument has evolved, actually. This court could do something like the alibi statute, the notice provision in sub 8A of the discovery statute. If it goes that far, I suggest perhaps rulemaking rather than superintending authority might be
That's right, and I totally agree, because I wouldn't do it without rulemaking or the legislature. But, you know, it looks like a duck here. It looks like you're asking for a rule, but you just don't want to fess up to it.
No. I agree that this is in some sense a rule, in that what I'm suggesting is that a trial court or a county or a judicial district could set up, as Jefferson County did, a rule that says for other acts evidence, you have to disclose it before trial. Or a court in a particular case could say whenever the opponent asks for the opportunity to investigate that, then a pretrial disclosure is a permissible requirement.
What's the authority for that? We'd set aside the superintending, because we both kind of are putting that aside. Then you have inherent. I'll tell you, in my mind, I set aside inherent authority. I set aside inherent authority because that's for the most unique and rarest of circumstances do I think the court should exercise its muscle and say inherent authority. So that leaves me with statutory authority. You know, what's the statute? 906.11, mode operation trial. But then I say, well, there's the statutory rule of construction that usually the general doesn't trump the specific. And here we have 971.23.8 that sets forth the specifics. Why should 906.11, the general, trump it?
Well, I think they have to be read in tandem. I also think that, respectfully, with respect to inherent authority, that the proposition that there are three components to inherent judicial authority. The first two are more administrative in nature, but the third one is efficient and, well, let me pull it to make sure that I don't miss this, but that, I think, fits, because that language is so much like 906.11. I think this is a unique instance. I think this is something that perhaps the legislature didn't think about when it was, when the discovery statute was evolving. For example, even reciprocal discovery requiring defendants to give anything to the state was a relatively new proposition, I believe 1995. So I'm suggesting that this is something that nobody even thought about. In fact, Wisconsin is in the minority of states that don't require even the government, the state, to disclose or give pretrial notice of other acts evidence. So I think this is one of those unique situations. The authority comes from just that inherent authority. And I think 906.11 can be read fairly, I think, to support that proposition and ran in tandem with the discovery statute.
So we should plug the hole with inherent authority rather than the legislature plugging it by a new legislation or us by rulemaking authority.
I think that's fair, yes. I think you can certainly do that. I think as a matter of practice, and I can't speak more than anecdotally, but that this is not uncommon, especially with respect to the state wanting to introduce other acts evidence, that trial courts say, you're going to have to do that before trial so we can go through this admissibility analysis so the defendant has a chance to address it as well. And vice versa with McMorris evidence. I think partly why we don't have much authority on this is because it isn't a very common situation. Or perhaps there are cases where the state says, yeah, I know about that other incident, I can figure it out. But there are going to be cases, and I suggest this may be one of them, where that may not be the case, where there are perhaps several other acts incidents, prior acts of violence that the defendant wants to introduce.
Counsel, it appears to me that your argument in regard to inherent authority is grounded, as you began to allude to, in 906.11. And specifically subsection 1, subparagraph small a, where the judge shall exercise reasonable control over the mode and order of interrogating witnesses and presenting evidence so as to do all of the following. Make the interrogation and presentation effective for the ascertainment of the truth. And do I misapprehend your argument, or does your argument center on that duty of the judge to promulgate rules and procedures that will ascertain the truth? And doesn't that really go to the state's, it was alluded to, the state's right or the state's ability to do some of the discovery that would be incumbent after the accelerated disclosure of the other act's evidence pursuant to the rule in Jefferson County? Is that pretty much the grounding of your argument?
In the language that you cited, especially that last part, make the interrogation and presentation effective for the ascertainment of the truth. If you look at Sunperry versus Davis, similar language is articulated in there for inherent judicial authority. So whether you choose one or the other or both, or conclude that 906.11 is a codification of inherent judicial authority, that's what I'm suggesting is the basis for the trial court to be able to do this. Once you get past that first step, although sometimes things are the first step and the reasons for the first step sometimes go together, but then you get into the policy reasons, and I talked about, I believe, the admissibility analysis that your trial courts must do, the efficiency concerns that attend to that, but also the fairness to the state. And to the defendants. With respect to the state, like I suggested, it may be impractical if beyond the witnesses named by the defendant, the state may need to find additional witnesses to a prior act. For defendants, they may want to articulate in their opening statement that we're arguing self-defense. This defendant has done all.
And in its fulfillment of that first requirement of ascertainment of the truth, if the court is going to allow the state time to effectuate all those things you were just alluding to, wouldn't that implicate subsection B, which is the avoidance of needless consumption of time? I mean, why? I think if I apprehend your argument correctly, it seems to me inherent in what you're saying, or implicit in what you're saying, is the avoidance of needless consumption of time.
That's appropriate also, I agree. With respect to defendants also, they argue they're going to want to question the complainant, the victim, who's testifying about, well, didn't you do these bad things in the past? If this information gets before the jury before the court has had a chance to address whether that's appropriate, then you've got the potential for a mistrial.
You've been talking a lot about other acts evidence, but look at sub 1B, 904.04.1B, character of the victim. What, if any, interplay does that statute have in your analysis?
I think that's the sort of the threshold for why the defendant can introduce character of the victim, and then sub 2 is a mode of doing that, other acts evidence.
Well, but it says, or by the prosecution to rebut the same. Isn't that part of the authority for knowing how you're going to rebut something?
Surely.
And what, if anything, does the language by the prosecution in a homicide case mean? Does it have to be a homicide that's completed, or can it be attempted,
proposition. It's where the state, because of the death, it's a homicide case, I believe, only, and that is because the death of the victim precludes that person from testifying, obviously. And in those cases, if the state has to be able to introduce evidence of the character of that victim in homicide cases. I'm not articulating that very well, but I think that's the limitation.
So you're saying the homicide case, part of that statute, doesn't really play here because there's no accomplished homicide. However, the part that says, you know, the evidence of a pertinent trait of character of the victim can be offered by the accused. You know, lack of peacefulness, that's a typical character type piece of evidence, even by specific instances of conduct, perhaps. But then the next part of that analysis, right in the statute, is or by the prosecution to rebut the same. So how are you going to know what you're rebutting unless you know what it is they're introducing?
Sure, and I think this case is about timing, not necessarily about, you know, the proper ability of the state to do it. It's when the state has to know about that information. And we're suggesting pretrial is a fair time to be able to allow the state to do that.
Thank you.
Mr. Freimuth, Justice Siegler's initial analysis is one that I can understand and to some extent agree with. But I have, in my writing, have often relied on 971.23. This is what the defendant gets, and it's, you just can't go way beyond that. If I were to buy your position, wouldn't I be pretty hypocritical?
The discovery statute is worded in the sense of must disclose. In other words, these are statutory rights that each party has that requires the opponent to do certain things. It's a must. It's a requirement. What I'm suggesting is that the statute doesn't prohibit what the trial court did here. This is discovery only in the limited sense of timing, that it comes before trial. I don't think it's your traditional type of discovery for the items that are listed in that discovery statute. It's because the trial court here needs to go through an admissibility analysis that it typically doesn't have to do, I think, for the other things that are listed in there. That's where this is different. I mean, I think there's this gap, if you will.
Are you saying that if the circuit court gets a motion from the defense that goes way beyond 971.23 and grants it?
No, I think you have to look at what is being asked for, and I think this is a unique situation, and that's why I'm suggesting take away my earlier argument about and any other orders. I'm not suggesting that you open up discovery to anything. I'm saying this is a unique situation that the statute doesn't address, doesn't prohibit, but that 906.11, inherent judicial authority, this is the type of thing that needs to be addressed before trial, or at least is permissible to be addressed before trial. It's discovery only in that limited sense. Discovery rights are intended, I see my time is up, if I may finish.
Take it away.
The discovery rights are just that. They're intended to really benefit those parties, and it helps the court too, but I think this is something that is really not a right in the party, but something for the court's benefit primarily.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
We'll have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Defense can proceed.
Good morning. It's the court. I am Michael Wilkes, and I'm here this morning to argue on behalf of Jason McLaren. I think that at the outset of my argument, it's important to note that while the state's counsel did advise or remind this court that we're here in a pretrial posture, I think that it's important to consider what goes along with the fact that this is here on interlocutory appeal, primarily the fact that at this point in the proceedings, Mr. McLaren is entitled to the presumption of innocence, and that has to be overcome by the state. I think that provides context for some of the rest of the arguments that we've advanced in our brief before this court. I think that I would also note, as one or more of the justices have this morning, that as the state's position has evolved over the course of the briefing here, that the trial court's order as presently construed by the state is not what the written order that was appealed from says. I think that there are three principal concessions that the state has already made that help illustrate the deficiency of the trial court's order. One would be, which really hasn't come up yet this morning, the apparent concession that at this point, in-camera review by the trial court of this evidence would be an appropriate first step. In point of fact, if you look at the record in this case, specifically R53, pages 88 and 89, that was suggested by defense counsel to the trial court as a means to sort of mediate between the tensions created by this order, to allow the trial court to review specifically what Mr. McLaren did or did not know, make a ruling about what would or would not come in, and then presumably only require, the defense to disclose that which the trial court deemed admissible during that in-camera review. That was suggested by defense counsel in this case. The trial court seemed to feel that that would be a way to balance the efficiencies with the defendant's rights, and specifically inquired of the state at that motion hearing whether or not that is something the state would agree to. And the state vehemently said, no, we don't think that's workable. We declined to go along with that. And in the face of the state's declination, the trial court simply discarded the notion. They appear to be conceding at this point that in-camera review would be an appropriate way to protect the Fifth and Sixth Amendment rights implicated here, while still allow the trial court to address some of the efficiency concerns that obviously prompted this order, at least in the trial court's mind. I personally do not believe that that was state trial counsel's interest. I think that they were clearly after a tactical advantage and they got it. But to the extent that the order stemmed from the trial court's legitimate concerns about efficiency, they now concede that in-camera review would be appropriate. That is not contemplated by the order that the state is asking you to sustain here. It was specifically asked for by defense counsel and rejected by the state in the trial court.
Counselor, are you arguing that in-camera review is necessary to a valid order, or just that it's one mode under which the trial court could have proceeded?
I am arguing that the Court of Appeals got it right, and there's no authority for this order. I think that if this court would elect to create a rule, or defer to rulemaking process or to the legislature, that would be one way to protect the Fifth and Sixth Amendment rights that are at issue here. I think that it would certainly be a way, with regard to what is in the defendant's mind, to avoid giving the opposing side tactical advantage by learning not only what was in his mind, but what was not in his mind at the time, and still allow the trial court to say, well, this is too remote, or this isn't really a violent act. So I think it would be a way to harmonize the interests of efficiency with the defendant's constitutional rights, but I believe the Court of Appeals got this case correct. I believe there is no statutory or inherent authority to do this. As Justice Prosser noted, the case law is pretty clear that this court has consistently interpreted the discovery statute as setting forth what both parties get, period.
Well, if we don't look at this as a discovery case, Counselor, if we look at it as a pretrial management of evidence at trial order, I think we have a little bit of a different construct. And my concern was whether you thought that an in-camera review was necessary to having any kind of a permissible order, or whether even with it, such an order would not be permissible. And if I understand you, it's the latter position. It's simply not permissible, even if there were in-camera review in advance.
I think that in-camera review would go a long way toward making any such order constitutional. I can't tell the court that I would disagree.
How would in-camera review give the court power it doesn't have?
In-camera review would give the court the power to order that disclosure.
Yeah, but where do you get the power for the in-camera review? I mean, the court can't just look at anything it wants to.
I agree. That's why I said I think the Court of Appeals got it right. I don't think that the present structure of the law, meaning the statute and the case law, would permit a trial court to order it. However, I do believe that if this court is inclined to create such a rule, either with this case or through the formal rulemaking process, that as the state now concedes and didn't concede before the trial court, that in-camera review would be a way to protect the defendant's rights.
Okay, but it's your position here today that even if the court had that part of its order, the orders without proper authority, the court doesn't have the authority to do that.
I would agree with that, yes.
Okay, I just wanted to be sure I understood your position. Thank you.
Mr. Witt, let me ask you about what I think you were getting to a few minutes ago. The Litton order in this case, as I understand it, does not in any way require reciprocity. Does that really make any difference since the judge apparently orally required reciprocity here?
I think it does, Your Honor, and I think if you actually look at the record, and I can probably find a pinpoint site, well, the trial court did, and as I indicated in my brief, and I mean no disrespect by this phrase, but did pay lip service to reciprocity. Mm-hmm. The trial court, I believe at R53, page 85, specifically lines 16 through 18, indicated that the trial court saw no conceivable obligation that this order was imposing on the state. And I think that's a far cry from the reciprocity required by Wardius. I think that at a minimum, the state would be required to disclose rebuttal evidence and rebuttal witnesses, and quite frankly, possibly other evidence that they discover. For example, in this case, the alleged victim is living. He can be interviewed. The defense has disclosed in writing the nature of its defense months in advance of trial, has provided a full witness list of all witnesses that he intended to call at trial for this purpose. The state can interview those witnesses, find out what they know or don't know about the accuser's violent past, can then go out and attempt to corroborate or find rebuttal evidence for those. And I think if in the process of that investigation, they discover corroborating evidence, evidence that would support the defense witness's testimony that Mr. Gale does in fact have a violent character, they would then have a Brady obligation to disclose that information. So I think reciprocity is critical to any constitutional order, whether it's issued by a trial court pursuant to some inherent authority, which I don't believe exists, or pursuant to rulemaking or legislative authority. I think that the case law is clear that reciprocity is required, and I think it would go beyond the bare-bones disclosure of rebuttal evidence, because I think inherent in that process of investigating the defense claims, interviewing those witnesses, finding out what those witnesses believe Mr. Gale has done or not done, they're going to discover corroborating evidence in addition to rebutting evidence, and they're going to have to disclose that to the defense.
Now, when you say the case law requires reciprocity, are you referring basically to decisions of the United States Supreme Court?
Yes, sir, specifically Williams versus Oregon, as cited in the brief. I think also that the concession by the state, although it really wasn't briefed extensively, argued that less drastic sanctions would have to be considered if undisclosed evidence were to come up at trial would also be critical toward a sustaining of this order or creating any sort of rule. I think that the state appears to be conceding that a Taylor versus Illinois balancing test would be required. And if you read all of the case law, even the case law cited by the state in support of exclusion as a sanction, virtually every one of those cases is rife with the notion that you have to consider a less drastic sanction first. And usually it's misconduct. There's one case where it was misconduct on the part of the attorney, but most of those cases hold that it has to be the defendant's misconduct himself that would result in exclusion for that purpose. So I think that also critical, as the state now appears to concede, for any constitutional order or rule, would be that you can't just say, if you haven't disclosed it, we're not going to hear it, let's move on, it's more efficient that way, but that it would have to require the consideration of less drastic sanctions for cause shown, which this written order clearly does not do. So when you look at those three major concessions by the state, which I don't believe are encompassed in the trial court's order, the propriety of in-camera review, the reciprocity required by Wardius, which I would read to include not just names of rebuttal witnesses, but also corroborating evidence, Brady evidence that would be discovered in that process, as well as the requirement that the trial court consider less drastic sanctions before excluding, I think would all be key to a constitutionally sufficient rule or order. And I think that they're absent when you look at this record for what the trial court did here.
Can you give me some idea of what you're talking about with less severe sanctions than exclusion of the testimony of the witness?
I can, and as a trial lawyer, it comes up all the time. I have had trial cases where the state has come up with evidence the morning of trial that they haven't disclosed, and I've objected as I filed a motion, this wasn't disclosed to me, and the trial judge has responded, well, counsel, will give you some additional time to review that if you need to, but we're going to go ahead and do opening statements now to keep this case rolling. And I've spent my lunch hours or my evenings catching up on whatever was disclosed. I think that it happens all the time, and just because in this instance it potentially happened to the state doesn't change the equation. I think it's also important to note that this danger of these repeated delays and adjournments or mistrials is being overblown by the state here. They have disclosure of the nature of the defense. They have a recorded statement from the defendant. They have the names of all the witnesses that trial counsel had intended to call when this case was set to be tried back in 2007, and presumably the means to interview those witnesses. The only thing they can't interview is the defendant, and that's precisely why this order cuts to the defendant's constitutional rights. It's not just disclose the nature of your defense, disclose your witnesses and what they're going to say. It divulges the contents of your own mind to the state pre-trial.
And counsel, isn't that information going to be divulged anyway?
Perhaps not. But frankly, as the trial court has already ruled in this case, the evidence could come in of Mr. Gale's violent conduct, not just from Mr. McLaren, but from other witnesses. So, for example...
But at some point, if the defense makes the tactical decision to go ahead with that line of defense, that information is going to have to be disclosed. So it seems to me that the trial court order, one interpretation of the trial court order, is that it simply accelerated the point of decision-making for the defense. And if I'm incorrect in that, please go ahead.
I would disagree with that. I think that the state has already received the benefit of everything that it's entitled to under Williams versus Florida. They have disclosure pre-trial of the nature of the defense. The second part of that ruling is that the defense can't wait for a verdict before deciding whether or not to testify. You can most certainly wait until the state has rested its case. And I would argue that the defendant's right to testify or not testify is unique to the defendant. It's not the province of trial counsel to weigh that any fact. And I always, always allow my clients to make that decision after the state has rested. This accelerates that to the point where my client is now required to disclose the content of his mind, not just the exculpatory content, but a fortiori, also what he didn't know about Mr. Gale's violent past. Allow the state to pre-trial tick off all the violent things they know that he's done, and we don't have to worry about those. Those aren't going to come up. Mr. McLaren didn't know about those. That would be solved by an in-camera review, which this order doesn't entertain. I also think that we have to be careful not to elevate efficiency here over the process itself. I think, for example, that an inquisition would be more efficient at disposing of cases, but it certainly would not be more efficient method of getting at the truth than the adversary system, and I don't think anyone here would suggest that it would be. So I think that there's pressures on trial courts that have to be acknowledged here. There's pressures on trial lawyers that have to be acknowledged here. You can't blame the trial judge when he's got a docket that's backed up for the next 36 months to try and accelerate the processing of these cases. But we're not processing widgets here. We're processing people, people with constitutional rights.
How is the defense prejudiced by the trial court's ruling here?
The defense is prejudiced because normally the mode and order of the presentation of the defense case is solely the province of the defense lawyer. I can sit back at my table and decide when I'm going to call what witnesses, subject only to my client's constitutional decisions, such as the right to waive a jury. I may want to do that tactically, but he has a right that has to be done pre-trial, such as the decision on whether or not to testify himself. This is going to force him to make that decision without seeing the strength of the state's case in a way that's going to impact that decision later. I mean, he's got to decide right now whether he knows how strong or how weak the case is. The state hasn't put on a stick of evidence. He's got to decide now and tell the other side whether or not he plans to testify under pain of being prevented from testifying in his own defense if he doesn't do so. That's how the defense is prejudiced. That's also how both the defendant's Fifth Amendment and Sixth Amendment rights are implicated.
How does that square with the Williams holding, the Florida v. Williams?
I think that Williams goes right to the defense. Williams says that the defense can't wait until after the state rests to disclose the nature of his defense. The defense hasn't done so here. Mr. McLaren told the police on the night he was arrested that he intended to pursue self-defense, and his attorney filed a motion months in advance of the scheduled trial date indicating not just an intent to pursue perfect self-defense, but also an intent to abuse McMorris evidence. So they have that prong of Williams met.
That decision's already been made. That brings us back to the question, how is he prejudiced?
He's prejudiced because exactly where defense counsel in this case drew the line when the trial court pushed. She drew the line at agreeing to disclose the contents of her client's mind pre-trial for the reasons that I've been discussing. Walked right up to that in full agreement that efficiency will be well served if we give you notice of this. We'll disclose our witnesses. The state can go out and interview them. Presumably, if they discover Brady evidence, they'll give it to me. But you don't get to probe, more importantly, the state doesn't get to probe my client's mind and find out not just what he did know about Conrad Gale's violent past, but what he didn't. They can structure their case to downplay the accuser's criminal record And Mr. McLaren has now had to decide ahead of time that he's going to testify and tell them what's in his mind. They can structure their case so as to make it disadvantageous for him to do so. So I think that exactly where trial counsel drew the line, despite the fact that she had absolutely no notice that the state was going to raise this issue, they didn't flag it in any way. No filings, no motion. It was raised orally toward the middle or the end of that hearing with no chance for her to respond. And I think she did a good job at stepping up and saying, it stops here. You don't get to force me to disclose the contents of my client's mind pre-trial.
If that information comes up in the middle of the trial, though, isn't it consistent with the trial court's authority to grant the state a continuance to do further investigation?
It certainly, I think, would be, but I think it's not likely. I think that if the state has done its homework, if the state has talked to the accuser, if the state has interviewed the defense witnesses, which have been disclosed, they're not accused of anything, they have no right against self-incrimination. To my knowledge, none of them are co-actors of Mr. Gale in any criminal activity. They can all be interviewed completely, not only about what they knew, but what they told or did not tell Mr. McLaren. So, for example, in this case, a witness could say, I knew Conrad Gale, I knew he went to prison for doing X, and I told Jason McLaren about that 2 weeks before this incident. That evidence will be relevant and admissible whether or not Mr. McLaren takes the stand. So I think that explains how deciding ahead of time...
But the court could grant the continuance.
Certainly could. And I just think that the likelihood of these massive delays are overblown if the state does its homework. And I can tell you, as someone who primarily practices in the trial courts, lawyers for both sides deal with this all the time. We're told in the morning, deal with it lunch, or stay late and figure this out tonight, counsel. It is not the world-ending 12-week continuing scenario. It's, did you interview those witnesses? What else do you need to do? Okay, well, we'll talk about it tomorrow morning. Let me know what you've got done. It's really not this train-stopping train wreck of a scheduling problem that the state would make it out to be.
Could I ask you, what obligation does the defense have with respect to notice about McMorris evidence before trial?
I think it's prudent to bring it up for efficiency's sake, and I think that it's interesting to note that with the three major concessions that are made here, I think that perhaps some sort of stipulation might have been arrived at in the trial court, but that isn't what happened here. I think that what trial counsel did in this case, was that she was cognizant of the local rule, wanted to cover her bases. I believe she filed a motion, if I have the record correct, in July for an October trial. There would have been ample time for the state to, in due diligence, investigate all of this. So I think that it would be good practice, and I think that a defense lawyer who decided to spring this by ambush does risk the state's demand for a continuance being met, the state's demand for a mistrial being met, and possible sanctions being imposed on trial counsel. But what you'd really be talking about there would be discouraging defense counsel from engaging in dilatory practice. And there's no need to make a discovery rule to do that. I think that most lawyers in the trenches, prosecutors and defense lawyers, work with each other on a daily basis and work these things out. I think that in the instance where a lawyer decided to spring this on opposing counsel, either for tactical advantage or due to late discovery, that would strengthen the other side's request for a continuance or even a mistrial. And at that point, the question of who gets sanctioned will depend on the facts. But I don't think the discovery rule is required to address that possibility.
What cases, if any, would have to be overruled or language withdrawn with regard if we followed the state's position? My question, more nuanced, is this. Time and time again, we have had cases in this court and the Court of Appeals that have been very restrictive about the interpretation of 97123. We look at what the DA must disclose, we look at what the defense must disclose, and have not gone beyond the confines of that statute. Now it's being argued that the judge can require disclosure under 90611, things that weren't required under 97323, can do it under 90611 for efficiency, mode, and operation of the trial. Would we have to overrule any of our consistently prior restrictive interpretations? limitations of 971-23?
I think it would do so, whether it was done overtly or sub silentio. I think that if you look at the history, you go back to Miller, there is no criminal discovery in the state. We don't recognize it. We've never have. The legislature promulgates discovery, and then I believe it's in Abraham. We aren't going to apply this retroactively. The legislature said you can have it effective July 1. Just because you were arrested before July 1 doesn't give you any rights. And then from there, the progression has been, I would interpret it the same way your question does. The case law has consistently held that there is no criminal discovery in Wisconsin as a matter of common law. That's a creature of the legislature, and we'll give you what the legislature says we have to give you. There have been, on occasion, clashes with constitutional rights, but I would note here that it's the defense, that the defendant personally, not necessarily the defense as a block, that has constitutional rights, not the state. And so I think that you would, if you grant the state's request, be overruling all of that prior case law, and I think that there would be people from both sides looking to march through that door. Which is why the principal argument in my brief was the Court of Appeals got it right. I think that, quite frankly, there's some appeal from, not from the posture of this case or the issues that are before this court and my argument on behalf of Mr. McLaren, but as a trial lawyer who does primarily defense work, there's some appeal to what the state is saying would be a good rule here. The ability to have in-camera review, the acknowledgement that Wardius does require the disclosure of rebuttal evidence in some cases, which is something that Wisconsin law has strayed from. The affirmation that less drastic sanctions than exclusion would be required. So it does have appeal to me, but it doesn't change my analysis that the Court of Appeals was correct. When you look at the history, from no discovery in criminal cases to then only that discovery which the legislature grants. I briefly cited in my case, and it's not directly on point because it was a civil case, but I believe State v. Shepp, which was a situation where under the refusal law, the Court of Appeals determined that that was a civil special proceeding and the defense was entitled to discovery, and the state was up in arms asking this court to create a rule so they didn't have to deal with that. And appropriately, this court sent the state to the legislature, and the statute was amended, and it was taken care of. And I think that that goes to the propriety of a formal rulemaking process or a legislative process rather than a case-by-case process, especially in a case like this where more than one of you has noted that the accuser here is alive. There's no restriction on the state's ability to ask him about what happened, about his own past, about his prison record, about his prior relationship with Mr. McLaren's wife. They can ascertain to a large degree what is or is not true simply by talking to him. Couple that with the ability to interview the defense witnesses other than Mr. McLaren, and they really don't need the pretrial disclosure of what was in Mr. McLaren's mind. Certainly.
With respect to other acts evidence, you typically would want the state to disclose that before trial, right?
I think that that's...
You would want the state...
I would want it. I think it is statutorily required, and I think that it is constitutionally required. None of those things apply to this disclosure.
Where is it in the 971-23? Where is other acts evidence disclosure required?
I apologize. I didn't mean to cut you off. It's not in 971-23. It's in 90404. In terms of the state's ability to use other acts, it's in the rules of evidence. And okay. So that's covered by the rules
of evidence. But it's not discovery. I hear you hanging your hat on the discovery and inspection statute as to what's required of the parties. What do you have to disclose before trial? Everything else can come up at trial and should. It just doesn't seem, I know and you know that issues come up at trial. You try to avoid as many as humanly possible. And when the unexpected issue comes up, sometimes it's a mistrial, sometimes it's take a look over the noon hour, sometimes it's I'm sorry, but you're going to have to deal with this tonight. But that's not the preferred method of dealing with evidentiary and other issues. The preferred method would be to have it be up front, dealt with, rulings made, and then the unexpected, unfortunate things that always come up during trial are dealt with during trial. Discovery and inspection, that statute, 971-23, does not require the state to disclose certain things that we routinely expect them to disclose and trial court judges rule on before trial. It strikes me that to say that everything is guided by the discovery and inspection statute isn't realistic because it's just not how it works at the trial court level. Why isn't what the judge did here, basically a ruling on evidence rather than a discovery issue.
I can answer that, because I would tend to agree with many of your observations about the beneficial aspects of working these things out pre-trial. But I think, number one, it's governed by the rules of evidence. And if you look at the specific things that are required to be done in 90404, this, I would argue, isn't covered by it. Second, I believe that in light of the rules of evidence and Jefferson County's local rule requiring that this be brought up pre-trial, the rules of evidence don't require this to be done pre-trial. All the case law that talk about pre-trial disclosures of this nature talk about being desirable but not mandatory, so the statute doesn't require it. I think coupled with local rule, that is why trial counsel did what she did, which was give the state notice of the specific nature of this defense, the general idea of the evidence that the defense intended to offer, months in advance of trial, and within a reasonable time prior to trial, disclose the names and addresses of all the witnesses that she intended to use for that purpose. So I think that the difference, what makes this different, is this order goes beyond those reasonable steps and requires the defense to disclose the content of the defendant's mind to the opposing attorney prior to trial under penalty of precluding him from testifying if he elects not to do so. That's the difference between what the state is asking for and what I think practice and the rules of evidence and local rules require. That's the key distinction in this case.
Thank you.
DeWitt, what specifically is required by the Jefferson County local rule?
That persons electing to, I believe it's put in 90404 evidence, do so in advance of trial. I mean, you can't show up on the morning of trial, state or defense, and say, oh, I'm going to bring in other acts evidence. That's the extent of it. It's a very brief rule, and I believe it's cited in its entirety in the state's brief.
And it's based on 90404.
That would be my understanding.
Do victims have any rights?
Victims' rights are covered by a specific statute, and they do. I have to acknowledge that those rights would be those afforded in the statute.
Well, there's a constitutional provision. The state shall treat crime victims as defined by law with fairness, dignity, and respect for their privacy. Could any decision be based on that?
I don't think so, because when you look at all of the case law regarding whether it's the application of a repeater statute or some other enhancer based on prior conduct, whether it's the impeachment of witnesses with prior convictions, when the accuser has, in this case, has been in and out of prison for committing crimes, I don't think that it's treating that person unfairly or being rude to them or being detrimental to them to explore the established facts of their history. So I don't think that this court could find authority in that victims' right provision, unless you're going to also open all sorts of questions regarding the ability to impeach with prior convictions. I think that short answer, I don't believe it's there. If I haven't answered your question, I'd be happy to try and clarify. I think the bottom line is here, as much as a trial practitioner, I would not mind seeing a truly reciprocal rule that afforded the possibility of in-camera review, that afforded a requirement to disclose rebuttal evidence that finally acknowledged the requirements of Voorhees, which was decided by the Supreme Court a long time ago. As much as I would like to see an affirmation of a requirement that less drastic sanctions must be considered before you can exclude defense evidence, especially the testimony of the defendant himself, as much as I would like to see an order that encompasses all of the things that the state now asks for made into some sort of rule, I believe the Court of Appeals correctly concluded that there's no authority for a trial judge to do that, and that it should be done either by this court's formal rulemaking process or the need for it should be taken to the legislature. I really think that in the context of the case law that existed before the enactment of the discovery statute, where there was no discovery entitled either way, I think that the legislature has preempted the field. They've modified that when they've seen a need to arise with the addition of the protective order provisions, with the need with regard to the DNA provisions and post-conviction. So I do believe that the Court of Appeals got it right, and I see that I have a red light. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
I'll try to respond to some of the questions. There isn't a lot of time, so I'll try to be quick. First, if 90404 sub 2 is read as requiring pretrial disclosure, or not, let's see, not requiring pretrial disclosure. It applies, it's party neutral, it applies to both parties, so that there's nothing in 90402 that talks about the timing of the disclosure. Second, I don't think this court has to overrule prior cases. Most of the cases that talk about, well, we're not going to grant discovery without defining what they mean by discovery, precisely. Those are all cases without court rule or legislation. Those are all cases that predated the enactment of the statute. And this is also, like I suggested in my first argument, this is a unique situation, I think, that those cases don't address. So even if you felt compelled to say, well, we just aren't going to open up the discovery statute, I think you can do so with this limitation in this unique situation. With respect to victims' rights, I think one of the concerns here is that if you allow the defense to put in what is other acts of the victim, the complainant here, and that information is not properly before the jury, you run the risk of denigrating that victim's character as well as harming the state's case and inviting a mistrial. With respect to in camera, the state's comment on in camera is linked to the constitutional concerns that may arise in this situation. In other words, if the defense believes that by disclosing before trial, before the state puts on its case in chief, other acts evidence of the victim, of the complainant, in camera would be appropriate only if the defendant suggests that by doing so, he would somehow be advancing the state's proof of the elements of the crime. In other words, self-defense basically is a concession that, yeah, I did these things, but this is why I did it. So generally speaking, you're not going to have a concern that by disclosing other acts of the victim, somehow you're going to enhance the state's ability to prove its case. Now, to the extent that there may be Brady evidence that has to be disclosed in that investigation, certainly the state has to disclose that. But I think this in-camera notion is limited to making sure that the state's case in chief isn't aided by the defense in making that disclosure.
On the facts of this case, what constitutional rights are implicated?
I think with respect to reciprocity, due process, perhaps, that the state has to make its similar disclosure. I don't think self-incrimination is at issue. This is evidence the defendant wants to present. It's not incriminating evidence. It's not compelled. The defendant doesn't have to present that evidence. He can choose to do so after hearing the state's case. Not to do so, that is. I don't think it is a Sixth Amendment right to present a defense problem, because we here are talking about arguably a rule, or however you want to describe it, court order that is designed to ensure that you're not presenting just a half-truth about what happened or about the victim. Attorney-client privilege doesn't apply because this order doesn't require McLaren to disclose confidential communications between himself and his attorney, and it is only the communications, not the facts relevant to the controversy, which are shielded by the attorney-client privilege.
One of the things you listed was the ability to present defense. And normally, as I would preside over criminal cases, it seemed to me that the idea of the mode and order or what was going to come from the defense sometimes was unknown. At the close of the plaintiff's or the prosecution's case would say, okay, now what? And didn't know it. We didn't know if the defendant was going to testify. We didn't know if the defendant was going to call a multitude of witnesses. And this rule is requiring, it seems to me, well, rule, first of all, it's not a rule, right? We don't want to call it a rule. Quack, quack, but we don't want to call it a rule. but this new creation seems to me that it has the potential to impinge upon the defense ability to control the mode and the order of the defense.
I think two things. One is, as I said, repeatedly, I don't want to beat a dead horse, but that this is a very unique situation. We're talking about McMorris evidence, self-defense situation, not across the board. Second, if things arise during the course of trial, if something happens, certainly, you can address it during the trial. I mean, there may be situations where a continuance may be the appropriate avenue for addressing some things, but I'm suggesting that don't, because of the possibility that such things might occur, don't preclude the trial court from addressing this pretrial, absent some showing by the defense that somehow this is going to be aiding the state's case or hurtful to the defense in some other fashion that hasn't been shown. Thank you. I see my time is up.
Thank you. Thank you both counsel for very good arguments, and we will stand in recess until the next case. Thank you.